Refresh your home today at Menards with window images, blinds, and shades. We have everything you need for updating your window treatments. We carry vinyl, aluminum, and faux wood blinds, cellular shades, and more. Save big on window treatments at Menards. Plus, get them cut to width in-store for free. Visit Menards.com and view our entire selection of window treatments today. Plus, the weekly flyer and other great deals going on now. Save big money at Menards.
Apologies for the ads. As an independent one-woman show, ads help me recover some of my costs. If you want to skip the ads, sign up to the exclusive feed. All episodes are free from ads, and there's full-length bonus episodes as well. The link is in the show notes. You can also make a one-time donation at buymeacoffee.com/amillionOTW. And on with the show, as they say. This is A Million Other Choices, and I am your host, Kim. I have an old historical case for you today, and I know that some of you don't care for oldies but goodies. But this one is probably one of the most significant to Canadian history when it comes to intimate partner violence, and unfortunately one that I'm going to have to battle through some names and places that I can't pronounce, and I already know that I'm going to get sidetracked by history tidbits and tadbits that have really nothing to do with this story today, but we are on this journey together. This is the murder of Pietro Napolitano. In the early morning hours of April 16, 1911, which happened to be Easter Sunday that year, a woman living in one of the poorer sides of town on James Street in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, which at the time was a new community township in the district of Algoma and largely populated by Italian immigrants who had started to arrive in Ontario in 1895, heard a soft knock at her door. And when she opened it, her 28-year-old and heavily pregnant neighbor, Angelina Napolitano, stood on the stoop holding her youngest son, Pietro Jr., who was just a toddler of 3 years old, and with speckles of blood dotting her otherwise clear-complexioned face, she said, "I've just killed a pig." And the neighbor, expecting an offer of sharing in her Easter dinner slaughter, invited her in. Only what she said next sort of dampened her Easter celebratory spirit. When Angelina informed her that what she had meant was that she had just smashed her husband Pietro of 12 years in the head and neck with an axe while he slept. So the neighbor rang up the police to come and check out the situation, which they did have phones back then, but it wasn't like today when you can just call 911. But there were phones, but maybe not in the less wealthy areas, and it's not like most people had the number handy, so maybe she just flagged down an officer. I actually don't know how it all worked. It was before my time, and I wasn't there, but the police did come and quickly arrested Angelina, who sat on her neighbor's sofa snuggling her little peanut, for murder, after climbing the stairs in their small little house to the second-level bedroom and finding Pietro with a shattered skull and, well, a whole lot of blood spattered on the walls, bed, and floor, I would imagine. And the wheels of justice worked a lot faster back then, some might even say too fast, and her trial started only 3 weeks later. I have no earthly idea what happened to her four children that she had after her arrest. There was Michael, who was 7, Amelia, 6, Raffaella, 5, and then Pietro Jr., who was 3. I would imagine they were taken in by a Catholic orphanage, because the couple had no other family in the country, and with the cost of an extra 3 mouths to feed, I highly doubt that her neighbor took them in, especially after she admitted to such a brutal murder in her living room, and probably, while doing it, dropped little bits of blood and brain on her carpet and teacups. So they probably didn't go there. Anyways, her trial lasted for only 3 hours. After her appointed lawyer, Uriah McFadden, was given a few minutes to speak to Angelina, she testified on her own behalf and admitted that she had killed her husband. The Crown attorney that prosecuted the case was Edmund Meredith, and she was found guilty by a jury of men, but they asked for leniency in her sentence because she was pregnant at the time. The judge, Justice Byron Moffat, was having none of that, though. After all, she had brutally swung the axe 4 times, mangling her husband, who was asleep at the time. So he sentenced her to hang on August 9th, 1911, which would be, they expected, about 2 weeks after she was due to give birth. And while awaiting her sentence, she stayed calmly in her jail cell, knitting socks and sweaters for her unborn child. And that's the end of the story. I'll see you next week. Only not quite. Angelina Napolitano was born on March 12, 1882, in a small town just north of Naples, Italy. There is really nothing known about her parents, her maiden name, or her upbringing, other than that her parents were farmers. She married Pietro when she was 16 in a Catholic church, and in around 1902, after about 4 years of marriage, struggling to put a roof over their heads, they, along with many others living in Italy at the time, immigrated to New York and settled in what became Little Italy. Pietro worked a number of odd jobs doing manual labor, but it was still a struggle, and Pietro had dreams of one day buying a house for the couple and their growing family. And there isn't a lot of information about the marriage in those early days between Angelina and Pietro, but I think it's fair to assume that Pietro was hot-headed and prone to taking his stress out on Angelina by using her as a punching bag, which is terrible, but so common in the early 1900s in marriages of all cultural backgrounds that it wasn't something that Angelina would have thought to flee from. It was just something that she had to endure in order to feed her kids, because it's not like back then she could just go to night school and learn a trade and then get a job. She had no job skills, she didn't speak English, and she's a woman. And remember, women didn't even have the right to vote until 1918, and even then it was only in federal elections. Angelina hardly saw herself as a suffragist. Early women's rights groups were made up of white, upper-middle-class women who had educations behind them. Now, the Salt Daily Star back in the day reported that during the years they were married in Italy, the marriage was just fine and dandy, and it was just that once they moved to North America, he became depressed and stressed out and started to beat her, which to me is potato, potato. Like somehow that makes a difference, and I seriously doubt it. Anyways, she is a poor Italian immigrant woman with 4 babies to feed and take care of. So in 1909, Pietro and Angelina moved to Canada, hoping for more work opportunities for Pietro on the railway or in the paper mill. And that's when they settled into a rented 4-room apartment in Sault Ste. Marie. And Pietro was able to get an actually decent paying job at the steel plant on the overnight shift. And then sometime in early 1910, Pietro up and disappeared. He went out one night drinking and he didn't return home. And as much as Angelina would have been happy not to endure his fits of drunken rages, she was also left with no way to feed and support her babies, let alone keep a roof over their heads. So she had to become a boarding house, even though their apartment was very small for her and 4 children already, where in exchange for meals and a place to stay, it's not quite like taking in a roommate where the person just pays a portion of the rent. It's just different back then, if you were wondering how taking in a renter would help feed her family. But anyways, the guy that she took in was a guy named Nish. Now, all reports say that she took up with him, as in started a romantic relationship. I cannot confirm or deny that. Obviously, I wasn't there. It doesn't matter, because after several months of being God knows where, Pietro showed up again. Now, the timing of his return, and this next part is probably very important, but it was so long ago that I can't get all the correct details. But in most of the reports, it was in November of 1910, it was when Pietro had returned, and all right around then was when Nish left. And then Pietro stabbed Angelina 9 times with a pocket knife in her face, neck, and shoulders, leaving her clinging to life and in the hospital for a number of weeks. She survived, but she was permanently disfigured. Pietro was arrested and charged with assault. Now, the part that I can't tell you is correct is that this all happened on the same day that he returned, or if he returned, kicked Nish out, and then there was some kind of altercation with Angelina on another day. But I'm thinking it might have been the same day that he returned, because at Pietro's trial, he claimed a defense of provocation, which a judge has to decide was an event caused by the victim to induce sudden rage and loss of control in the perpetrator. And if he claimed that coming home, now he probably didn't mention his abandonment of several months, to finding a man in his house was provocation. So anyways, in the end, it didn't really matter because the judge suspended his sentence because he was the only breadwinner and his family was better served with him out of prison and other barbaric legal crap. And Pietro went home and continued his tyranny, and it only got worse. Pietro had decided that things had to change and they needed to buy a house, and to do that, he needed money. And now he wasn't going to be able to make more money, and he was working hard enough, he felt, as it was. And after months of disappearing, I imagine his decent paying job at the steel mill wasn't there for him anymore. So it was going to fall on Angelina to make that money. Now, how is an unskilled Italian-speaking immigrant woman with a disfigured face and four kids, and now another one on the way, thanks to Pietro's loving and joyful reunion home to his wife, going to earn that money? Well, that was easy. Prostitution. Only Angelina was Catholic, with a strong belief that women that were not virtuous were condemned to hell, which is a very scary and awful place, and one that was eternal. So she, of course, refused. But Pietro kept at her, and he figured over time, and maybe with enough beatings, she'd come to her senses. So, and he would also help things along by sending potential clients over to his house, but she, who was now quite visibly pregnant, would refuse to open the door and sent them away, further infuriating Pietro. Finally, in the very early hours of April 11th, 1911, he came home from his night shift and told her, "I'm going to bed, and when I wake up, there better be some money on the table. And if not, I'm throwing you out on the street, and then I'm going to hunt you down and kill you for abandoning your family." So Angelina, believing his threats and fearing for her children's future and her unborn baby's ability to withstand another beating, she went out to the woodshed and grabbed the axe and walked up the stairs to her bedroom and whacked Pietro four times in the head, shattering his skull. Then she put the axe back and walked to her neighbors and let her know that she'd just killed a pig. So when Angelina's trial began, it actually wasn't until that day that Justin Byron Moffat realized that Angelina had never been appointed a lawyer. So he quickly assigned Mr. McFadden and gave him the rest of the day to get his defense figured out. Now, the next morning, during this three-hour trial, McFadden wasn't allowed to raise the issue of the stabbing that had happened in November 1911, because as the judge said, quote, "If anybody injured 6 months ago could give that as justification or excuse for slaying a person, it would be anarchy complete." So the defense of battered wife syndrome was out of the question, and because it was also not a thing yet. So when she went on the stand, all that she could really argue was that if she had not killed her husband, she would have been forced into prostitution and forced to give up her morals and virtues. But the jury didn't so much care about that part as much as they felt that she probably shouldn't be hung because of her unborn baby, which at the time was believed if a woman during pregnancy was in an agitated state, say facing an execution, the baby would suffer psychological harm, and as they grew up, the cycle of axe murders would continue. The Crown attorney argued that if Pietro was asleep at the time and no threat to her, that she was perfectly at liberty to leave. And it wasn't actually until 1990 with R.V. Lavely that the defense of battered wife syndrome was actually allowed, and that the threat did not have to be immediate, but only perceived to be immediate. And so when she first was convicted and the sentence of death was handed down, that would have been it for Angelina, with the papers writing stuff like, "Hot-blooded foreigners are all too ready as it is to use the knife, the pistol, or any other weapon that lies at hand at means of redressing real or fancied wrongs," or that she had been immoral for taking advantage of her husband's absence to bring in a boarder. But the Toronto Suffrage Association, which was one of the earliest women's rights groups, published an editorial in the papers asking, "The association sincerely hopes that in all societies and individuals throughout the country who feel that this unfortunate foreign woman should not, owing to the circumstances surrounding her care, suffer the extreme penalty of the law, will in some way make their desire known to the Minister of Justice." Now, at first, they used the fact that she was pregnant to get people on their side, but the Globe went a little bit further and wrote, "A woman may still be arrested by men, judged by a jury of men who naturally are much less her peers than the feudal baron was the peers of his serfs, and condemned to death by a male jury and male judge. This state of things is equivalent to a remnant of barbarism which ought not be allowed to survive this generation. And they also said that hanging a woman only weeks away from giving birth was a deed of torture which exceeds anything devised by the Spanish Inquisition. And so with that, letters started pouring in and petitions to the Minister of Justice, 7 bags full of letters, in fact, all asking for her sentence to be commuted to life, including one man, Dr. Alexandra Alto, who offered, "It would only be fair to Mrs. Napolitano for a man to give his life for her, inasmuch as her life is in peril on account of a man's persecution of her and because men condemned her. I know my own mother would consider that I was honoring her motherhood by dying for Mrs. Napolitano." And these letters and petitions were from all over Canada, the U.S. and Britain, saying that executing her was wrong. But not everyone was on Angelina's side. The Sault Daily Star crucified her, basically saying everyone was trying to paint her as this martyr for women's rights, saying Mrs. Napolitano is not the angel the American press make her out to be. Of course, a summer campaign to save a worthless woman could hardly be made interesting. So Mrs. Napolitano is painted as a beauty in distress, a virtuous woman who was driven to murder to save herself from becoming a white slave. But only a distortion of the facts can public sympathy be worked up for the woman herself. And that Pietro was the better of the two by great odds, according to the residents of Little Italy. It was evident that the crown officials looked on Mrs. Napolitano as deserving all she got. Actually sharpened the axe and put it carefully away in preparation for the deed before smashing his head. A more thoroughly depraved human being it would be hard to imagine than this taciturn, coarse woman. But the overwhelming number of support and outcry for Angelina's clemency of over 100,000 people put enormous pressure on Canada to commute her sentence. The federal justice minister, who at the time was Sir Alan Bristol Aylesworth, which is a name that if it doesn't spell white privileged, I don't know what does, was still appalled and incredulous about her support, saying she chopped the head of a man into pieces while he was asleep. The agitation the newspapers have worked up for this case seems to me the most uncalled for thing I have yet seen. But due to the political pressure, just before she gave birth on July 14, 1911, her sentence was commuted to life, and about 2 weeks later she gave birth in August to a baby girl who sadly died of unknown causes a few weeks later. Now her other children were later placed in foster homes and then adopted. And on December 30th, 1922, she was paroled from the Kingston Penitentiary after serving 11 years, and this was about 3 months before her 40th birthday. She went to work for the Nickel family at 155 Earl Street in Kingston, and I believe Mr. Nickel was a prominent lawyer in the area. She worked for them as a domestic, or basically a maid. Now, some reports said that she disappeared for a while after that, leaving Kingston in 1924. But the Canadian Encyclopedia says that she was actually still in the Nickel family's employ when on September 4th, 1932, at the age of 49, she went into septic shock from a tooth infection and died at the Kingston's Hotel du Hospital. It is known that during her time in prison and afterwards that she made attempts to contact her children, but no one knows if she was ever successful in that or what their reception or opinion was of her. However, at the time of her trial, her oldest son Michael wrote in a letter to his mom saying, "Dear Mama, I hope you will come home to us soon. Amelia takes good care of us, but we all want you. We are lonesome every night without you." And this letter, interestingly enough, was published because Honor Fanning, who was a correspondent for an American paper and sympathetic to Angelina's cause, had come to visit her in prison and wrote about how she was knitting clothes for her baby, so he was the one that had tracked down her children. She is buried at the St. Mary's Cemetery in Kingston and was the inspiration of Frank Canino's play, The Angelina Project, and Sergio Navarrete's movie Looking for Angelina that came out in 2005. She is hailed in Canadian history to be the first woman to ever use the battered wife syndrome, but we know that that's actually not really true. She would have claimed it, but she wasn't allowed to, so she actually went with the upholding her virtue defense. In Canada, first woman to have used the battered wife syndrome actually goes to a Manitoban woman named Angelique Lynn Lavallee, who on August 31, 1986, when she was only 22, shot and killed her common-law husband, Kevin Rust, in the back of the head after he had left the room. Her defense arguing it was a final desperate act by a woman who sincerely believed that she would be killed that night. She was acquitted, but then that was overturned, and then there was a second trial ordered, and it did go all the way to the Supreme Court that finally decided that the testimony of her psychiatrist, who said that she had felt trapped and terrified and unable to escape, was admissible, and so her acquittal was upheld. And that, my friends, is how Kim teaches history lessons. And with that, I'm going to be back again next week with another case. Please do that rate review thing on Apple or Spotify. It helps that algorithm for me to show up in more searches. And apparently, even negative reviews do, because it's all about rate counts, not the actual average review number, which is so unfair, I think. Now, so far, thank you. I have not gotten any negative reviews. A couple of one stars, but nothing terrible, which I am so thankful to you guys for, because I have seen some brutal reviews out there on podcasts that I personally really like. So the fact that y'all have been so kind so far is just really means the world to me. So thank you so much for listening and sharing and writing me and connecting with me on Instagram and Facebook. I feel like I've built a really great community of support, and that just keeps me going. So I thank you so much for that.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price.
This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
Medical Mutual wants to remind you it's almost time for Medicare's annual enrollment period. As a trusted health insurer for more than 90 years, Medical Mutual is here to help you find better Medicare benefits. Be confident you're getting the most from your Medicare Advantage plan. Schedule your free Medicare plan review today at medmutual.com/review. Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
The world of 911 emergency dispatching is brutally diverse. One minute you can be talking with someone about parking violations.
What's the process we are to take to have people towed? Because it's actually delaying the mail.
And then all hell can break loose. Then the rest of the day is crazy. We could have murders.
Hill County 911, what's your emergency?
I just killed my children.
Home invasions.
He's in my house. I shot him.
You shot him?
He was coming up towards me and I shot him.
Natural disasters.
Tornado came through and got us. I'm buried under a bomb to all my life.
Even bombings. My show, Music City 901, will put you in the dispatcher's chair. Put you ear to ear with the callers and responders. And keep you on edge from start to finish. I hope to both educate and entertain, as I'm a 911 dispatcher with over 20 years experience. And just like dispatching, every episode is different from the last. Music City 901. Real 911 calls. Real 911 dispatchers. Available to listen to on any podcast app.